we're wearing out the ocean, we're wearing out the fish, and if we don't do something about it, our grandkids won't be able to enjoy it.
Part of our value proposition is that it was in the water 24 hours before it was served at the restaurant.
Our coast impacts the entire state. If you think economically between our ports, the charter industries, recreation, commercial, our blue economy here in Georgia, I mean, it's a multi-billion dollar industry.
This is my 59th year taking people fishing. So I've gone through keeping...
I'm David Zelsky, and this is the Fork in the Road podcast, presented by Georgia Grown and the fine folks at Georgia Public Broadcasting. Each episode, we feature stories from Georgia's farmers, fishermen, merchants, artisans, chefs, and others who help provide Georgia Grown products to folks in the Peach State and beyond.
I came from the mud, there's dirt on my hands, strong like a tree, there's roots where I stand.
Today, we are about 18 miles east of Savannah on Tybee Island. Spanish explorers laid claim to this area in the year 1520, but Native Americans lived on the land long before the Spaniards arrived. For more than 100 years, Tybee Island has been a popular destination for those looking for clear saltwater breezes and laid-back beaches. Tybee has also been the home to pirates, war heroes, a lost nuclear bomb, and the famous Tybee Post Theater. This episode of the Fork in the Road podcast is special. It was recorded in front of a live audience with some very special guests. Chef Dave Snyder is executive chef of the Halyards Restaurant Group out of St. Simon's Island. That's restaurants like Halyards, Tremici, La Placha, and Hal the Food Truck. Dave is a member of many panels and committees that have an overall mission of protecting and preserving our coast. Captain Judy Helmy, well, she used to be the youngest captain on this coast, and now, well... she's a fisherman, charter boat captain, storyteller, entertainer, psychic, author, crystal ball reader, meteorologist, speaker, psychiatrist, parking attendant, secretary, and I gotta say, she's been kicking fishtail since 1956. Next, we have Laura Solomon, co-founder of the Tybee Oyster Company at Bull River Ranch. This is Georgia's first floating oyster ranch. We'll explain what that is later. And she's an educator at the Tybee Island Maritime Academy. And last but not least, Brian Flick, Associate Director of the Extension at the UGA Extension and Georgia Sea Grant since 1915. He's responsible for coordinating. I said 1915.
Yeah.
You look great.
It was close.
You look great, Brian.
We're going to stick with that.
Okay? Yes.
Since 1915.
This guy knows a lot. Since 2015. He is responsible for coordinating marine extension activities across the state and also serves as the unit's fisheries specialist. So thank you, Brian. All right, and without further ado, our live podcast, Hope on the Water. Going down to the end, Captain Judy, you love this coast. Your dad loved this coast, these waters. What's it mean to you?
He used this coast and the waters in it to make everything the way he did. You know, my father was a very interesting character. I think I could sum him up by saying he was married 8 times. Never stopped dating. Always drank a fifth of liquor before he went out every night between 5 and 7. Loved to fish. Fast cars. And he built cars for Al Capone. I wanted to show y'all this. This is the boat my father, this was his first charter boat. And the highway department gave him a 50-gallon drum of paint. And he painted his boat Highway No Passing yellow. There it is right there. So he says they will see me now.
Captain Judy, we might get to a little more about moose later in this program, because there's a lot of stories. There was a picture I was trying to go there of Al Capone. But we'll get back to that. Let's move on a little. Let's move on a little. Brian.
Yes, sir.
What's the coast mean to you? You haven't always been down here, but you sure know a lot about it.
Yeah, and I grew up in Atlanta, and I love, even though it's a relatively small coast, we have so much to offer if you think about our natural resources, our marshes, our beaches, the waters. The history, good, bad, or ugly, I mean, that's all part of it. The culture that we have here, I think the fact that most of our population doesn't live on the coast, and when they come down here, recognizing how special it actually is. We're pretty fortunate when you look at most of our coastal states that, you know, we're relatively undeveloped compared to a lot of others. And so I think we have so much here to be thankful for and for the people that work on the water. And it is one of those things, just as a biologist, being able to share that and educate people about the importance of that and trying to find solutions that hopefully allows people like Judy to keep working, but, you know, still make sure that we have a coast that people can really, you know, love and stick with. So it's something I love going to work every day to be able to do it.
And it is so unique because the bird life, the marine life, this coast is special. It is protected, and it means a lot to this whole eastern seaboard.
Absolutely. I mean, you think about tourism, how big that is. I mean, we're here in Tybee. We don't have that without our beaches and our salt marshes, and so let alone the seafood that we eat, but the people that come here to go and visit our coastal communities, that's part of our identity, and I think that's the fascinating thing. And as someone who grew up in the state but not on the coast, now that I live here, it's that much more important to me. But yeah, realizing just what that means, and even if you don't live, you know, even if you're in Atlanta, our coast impacts the entire state. If you think economically between our ports, the charter industries, recreation, commercial, our blue economy here in Georgia, I mean, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. So if we don't have those marshes, all of us up here, I mean, our livelihoods are impacted by that. So I think that's certainly worth protecting.
Laura, let's move on to you. Years ago, tons of oysters were here in Georgia. The oysters are here now, but they were an industry, and then it was gone. You dedicate your time. You're teaching at the same time, but you and your husband, Perry, dedicate so much of your time to oysters. Why oysters? What is it? What do they mean to you? Why here? Why are they so special?
I keep hoping I'm going to have a really good answer to this. But no, oysters are something that Perry and I started enjoying together when we were a lot younger. And as we traveled around and would go out to eat, it was always kind of a special treat. Something we really have loved about it in restaurants is that it really is local, hyper-local. You know, it's got the water from the ocean in it when you eat it. So, you know, since we do enjoy eating and going out to restaurants, that's kind of what piqued our curiosity about getting into this industry here. And it's been really cool to see the support and the uptick. And then, you know, of course, they give back to the environment, which is really powerful. So
explain that real quick.
They filter water. They create habitat, especially in living shorelines, for fish and other animals to live in. And they help protect from erosion as a living shoreline as well. So they really do kind of create a community. And we're trying to utilize that as an education tool and also as food.
Chef, Captain, Dave, we've gone fishing a lot together.
Yeah.
We've eaten a lot together. We've had beers together. We had a good time. Dave, what I've learned talking with you is how much sustainability of the fishing industry means to you. And you don't just talk about it. You practice that at your restaurant. Tell me what this coast means to you and how you show it at your restaurants.
Thanks for, I speak for all of us, thanks for having us all here today.
Exactly. Of course.
No, the coastline, you know, ditto for a lot of what y'all have already said. For me, you know, it's a place to live. Great people, great communities up and down the coast. St. Simon's, where I'm from, it's a remarkable place. From a business standpoint, like Brian said, without seafood, my restaurants may not do so well. So it's important for my financial well-being, for all of my staff's well-being. But the beauty of it for me is probably the most important. I'm hopefully on the water 150 days a year before I go to work. After I'm done with work, I'm out on the water. It gives me peace. It gives me, it's just my place. It's my happy place. Mm-hmm. So we've got to protect it. For a multitude of reasons, we're wearing out the ocean. We're wearing out the fish. And if we don't do something about it, our grandkids won't be able to enjoy it the way that we do. So we got to do something about it.
And snapper and grouper are great fish, but there are others out there.
They're not the only ones. And exactly. Part of our job, I think, in the restaurant industry is to share with people, hey, try this fish. You know, triggerfish, nobody ate triggerfish 20 years ago, or very few people did. But unless, you know, you were hanging out with Judy's dad, you probably didn't know what a triggerfish was 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we got to figure it out.
Captain Judy, can I go back to Moose?
Yes.
Savannah's first charter fishing business, but there was something else that he did at that garage
Yes.
That garage, and it's in a museum somewhere around here.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, he was made an offer. He was made an offer that he couldn't turn down. So, and he met Al Capone. He came to Daddy's shop, and Al Capone's car was broke down. Well, he didn't know it was Al Capone at the time. And he wanted Daddy to fix it. And Daddy said, well, you know, you can just go down to the Ford place and tomorrow morning and they'll give you, you know, they'll fix it for free. He said, I didn't say I wanted to go to the Ford place. I want you to fix it. Can you fix it? He said, yeah, but it's going to cost more than the car is worth. So he, you know, peels out like hundreds of dollars. And Daddy says, okay. He goes to, he gets his man to go back there and fix it. And he finds out later that his man gets a hold of whatever he's got in the car, in the truck, which is not vegetables. It's full of vegetables. It's got a lot of liquor in it, and the guy's drinking it. And so Daddy had to work all night long to finish it. Then he figured out that that must have been Al Capone. He recognized him, but he wasn't sure. And he tried to go over there and leave the keys or whatever over there for Al Capone, leave the car. And the guy said, he wants to see you. And so Daddy said, how did he know we took some of his liquor? Oh, my God. So he goes up there, and Al Capone says, you know who I am? And Daddy said, I think I do. He says, well, you know, I think you could help me do a lot. And that's how it ended up. Daddy would get the cars, build them so that they would haul liquor and you wouldn't know that they were loaded down. He figured a way to get the liquor out of the ocean into... It was a mess.
Well, it was a mess. And he needed someone else to drive the boat, so he had this 14-year-old taking people out. So nice of you to step up and help with that end of the business.
Yeah, because he booked too many boats, and he said, my daughter can take you. And I went, I'm 14. And I did. I took him.
It's obvious you love this coast. And how have you seen it change through the years? I'm sure there's things you don't like, but it also could be comforting to see some of the things people like the ones up here are doing to help preserve it, to get the word out about what we can do to help this coast.
Well, you know, I've gone through, this is my 59th year taking people fishing. So I've gone through keeping, thank you, thank you.
You know, but when I started in 1915,
she came along. It was great.
The old Brian
yes,
Flick.
It was great.
I'm always the oldest, telling you. So I started fishing when we didn't know what anything was. All we knew was we kept black sea bass, we kept snapper, and that was it. And you're right about the triggerfish. We couldn't never figure out how to clean them. So we just, you know, we threw them back. But they're very good to eat. So... You know, we would, if we didn't catch the premium fish, the other fish, we would just throw back and sometimes Daddy'd just say, just kill it. And I'm like, well, I didn't know any better, so we did what we did. But as time has gone on now, we find more people catching and release fish now. We even take trips now for 10 hours, go offshore, and all they want to do is catch and release. They might want to keep a few fish, which I think is good. Because, you know, we've come a long way. We've killed the fishery, and, you know, we killed the fishery in the 80s. In the 90s, we looked for fish. Then they closed the red snapper. All we have is red snapper now, so it did rebound. So I think that it's going the right direction. Because all the people that are, we call them 1,000-pounders. They feel like they should have 1,000 pounds of fish for their $2.95 that they paid for the trip. So a lot of the 1,000-pounders are gone.
I work a lot with the commercial shrimping industry, and that's, you know, that's our largest commercial industry. And like Miss Judy, I mean, they've gone through a lot of changes.
That is Brian Flick. He knows about every creature that is in the water, and trust me, he cares about every single one of them.
We're in a global market. I mean, you know, keep in mind, Georgia's not a huge commercial seafood harvesting state, but we're a huge seafood processing state. But so things that are happening halfway around the world has an impact. And so, you know, one thing I always try to tell people about our fisheries, it's not perfect, but we do have that management. We have the management at the state level, the regional level, the federal level. You know, fish don't read a sign that says, I'm now entering South Carolina or coming into Georgia. So there's a lot of people working at, but as far as like the shrimp industry, they're having to deal with a lot of socioeconomic challenges. You know, you don't go to UGA to become a shrimper. You learned it from your grandfather, your father, your uncle. You know, and this was a source of pride. It's a source of pride for our communities, but it's gotten harder and harder for the shrimpers to make a living. and trying to compete. And this is going back to the tourism. It's a huge opportunity for people to support when they, you know, every time they go to that restaurant, they buy that local product that's providing stability for the industry. But that's something the industry is having to face. Fishermen are resilient. They're always going to try to find that new opportunity to stay on the water and find new ways to keep a living. But there's a lot of challenges, and it's, you know, use the analogy death by a thousand cuts. It's little things here, little things there, and it just happens over time. A lot of times, you know, we want management actions to happen right away. That's not always the case, of course. So I think there are always going to be those cycles. But, you know, that is a message I always try to let people know, that, you know, we do have well-managed fisheries here. Again, that doesn't mean in management there's not always, again, you mentioned the red snapper. There's always going to be issues with that. But it's, I always tell people when we talk about sustainability, yes, the environmental aspect has to be there. But sustainability is also those trade-offs on the social and the economic sides, mm-hmm. too. And we have to consider that, because, you know, when they can't pull away from the dock because the fuel prices are so much, or they can't find crew, that's a big issue of what we call grain of the fleet. And this is not just unique to Georgia, but where does that next industry, where's that next generation of our seafood providers come from? So I think there's a lot, and this is what's awesome about what Laura and Perry are doing, and just in general, the aquaculture that provides an opportunity. But even for our wild harvested, people want local, they want to support, but we also have to have the infrastructure to support them. We have to have the workforce. So it's a lot of multifaceted issues that took decades, and it's probably not going to just happen overnight. But I think one of the best things that I love about my job, you know, just because you have letters by your name doesn't mean you're always the expert. And I work for a university. I think listening to the people that work on the water, trying to find, and I always joke with my staff, part of our job in extension is bring tinkers and thinkers together. We need the models, we need the theory, that's fantastic. We also need the reality. We need the kind of practical experience, and how do you come together to find that proverbial mousetrap that is gonna allow us to have that conservation, sustainability, but allow them to keep fishing. So I think that's a huge piece that we see in our industry.
Laura, you work directly with UGA Extension to get your oysters. Explain how that whole process works and how important it is and the relationship you have with UGA Extension and Georgia Sea Grant.
UGA Marine Extension really is the backbone of this industry, and they have been at the forefront of oyster farming in Georgia for several years now. UGA was given a contribution, a sea grant, to start the hatchery out on the Skidaway River. So they literally grow the oysters that we purchase and sell.
How many
do they grow a year?
Like, give a ballpark.
I don't even know that I know.
Three, I forgot how many millions.
Phone a friend.
Yeah. Millions.
I would say, yeah, on the order of magnitude of millions for sure. I mean, when we purchase them, they're already several weeks old, and they're, you know, the size of like a grain of quinoa. if you've seen those before they're cooked. So tiny, tiny. We actually start them out in 1 millimeter mesh bags. So we're purchasing them, and, you know, it's a lot like a nursery that you do with plants. We purchase them small and grow them out. But in addition to growing the seed and making sure that, you know, they're finding broodstock from the coast that's both beautiful and resilient, they go and harvest oysters from wild rakes, look at the color of it, look at, you know, if it survived a disease outbreak. They bring it back to the lab and use it as broodstock to then hatch into oysters for us to purchase. They also feed it, you know, the right amount of algae. They use the Skidaway River nutrients as well, but supplement it as needed. And in addition to that, they've tested out multitudes of different types of equipment on the water to check for how things grow on the baskets, to see, you know, how quickly different systems will get fouled up, how easy it is to navigate on the water. So they really have created a wonderful resource for us. Even if they don't have the answer, they've probably tested it and have some theories. We work with them every other week to come out and test for different things on the farm. So it's a continuing relationship.
And part of that too, keep in mind, it's partnerships. Yes, we're involved in that, but, you know, whether it's Georgia Department of Natural Resources, whether it's groups like Grays Reef or Sapelo Island National Estuarine Research Reserve, or private, you know, industry partners, that's, and most times no one entity is going to have all the resources. So I think that's another thing that's the benefit of the having this coast. We have a lot of different organizations, whether it's governmental, whether it's NGO, whether it's private. even though we might have disagreements on how to get there, I think the ultimate goal is we are, you know, I think we have that common vision in many cases, and devil's in the details sometimes, but I do think that's an important piece of all the work that's being done up here. It's not being done by just one entity.
And not just how to get there, you know, quickly, but how to get there the right way to address the economic, the sustainability, and all
safety,
the different facets. Even starting the oyster farm that we have, the DNR went and looked at other states and wanted to be really cognizant of states that had people complain about, you know, unsightly oyster baskets in their backyard. So they've really done a lot of research to make this an industry that has as few negatives as possible.
Dave, Chef Dave, how hard is it to find the local ingredients you need when it comes to the seafood? You have the connections here. You got
It's very difficult. Well,
yeah.
It depends on what's your definition of local.
Right, yeah.
If it's only the Georgia coast, I mean, how many commercial guys are on the Georgia coast now? Three? Literally.
A few more. I mean,
five?
Just
maybe
to give you,
commercial
yeah,
licenses?
Just to give, yeah.
There's not many.
Just to put in perspective, I think like late 70s, there were over 1,500 licenses issued for shrimp trawlers. That doesn't mean that's how many boats. Past few years, there's barely been 200. I mean, just we've had massive just declines for various reasons. I mean, it's not one factor.
But for people's favorite fish, reefish, groupers, snappers, triggers, maybe three?
Three.
In the entire state. So we're fortunate that we all know one of them, and we do a little bit of work with him. But it's an hour drive for him to come to us. And it's hard for him to sell to us, to maybe one other fish broker, too, in Brunswick on his drive. I understand that it makes more sense to him to make one phone call to call one broker in Canada and ship all of his fish at one time. So it's a little bit difficult. And then the regulations that we incur in the South Atlantic between January 1st and May 1st, you can't harvest any groupers or snappers that sell a lot of. Most of them, all the shallow water species, they're all spawning. So when we have tourists come down in February and they say, we want some local fish, I say, I don't have any. I might have some speckled trout if I'm lucky. I probably won't have any flounder. And they'll say, well, you know, we went down to 30A in the panhandle of Florida last month and we had grouper. And I have to explain, that's a different set of rules and regulations because that's a different council. So there are political, you know, reasons that I don't have them because a different council manages our water. I have, even in season, difficulty finding local fish because there are only three people in this entire coast that harvest those types of fish.
And I know you take a hit in the pocketbook trying to keep it local.
Oh, absolutely. And then the hard part is I'm trying to sell to you a $38 piece of grouper. We were saying before this started this evening that one of our friends sells fish, and the last invoice I had from him was a $600 invoice. And he dropped off three fish.
Wow.
It's expensive. And then I've got to turn around and I've got to convince our guests to give me 38 of their dollars for 1 6-ounce piece of fish. It's difficult.
You don't just cook, but you also go out there. You do a little of what Captain Judy does. You like fishing. How important is, you go out, you experience the coast, you see the coast. How important is that for you? Being a restaurant owner, experiencing the coast and seeing it and understanding it.
Well, it's the full circle. One of my better days might be a family comes from somewhere inside off the coast, right? They're from Chattanooga, maybe. And they'll fish with me and charter in the morning. We'll harvest maybe a black drum or a flounder or a trout. And then they'll come into my kitchen that night at one of the restaurants, and I'll fillet the fish in front of them. I'll cook it for them, and they'll sit at the chef's table and eat it. And that full circle is really great, especially for kids. It's a great experience. So sharing that, I mean, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Laura, working on the Oyster Ranch. There is a nickname you have for the oyster.
Salt Bomb.
Salt Bomb.
Yes.
Salt Bomb.
They're very good.
And the name Tybee means?
Salt. So Tybee is a Native American word for salt. So it's kind of a nod to the cultural heritage here. You know, over 10,000 years ago, Native Americans were consuming oysters in a sustainable way, there's evidence to show, which is really cool. So the salt, yes, they're salty, they're briny, but also, Tybee means salt. And then the bomb is, you know, a reference to the way it pops in your mouth when you have one, but also the legend of the bomb.
Correct.
off the coast. Yeah. So you can actually see the Wausau Sound which is, you know, from our lease. And they came down in 1996 for the Olympics. The sailing venue was there and scoured the ocean floor for it with no evidence of it. But
it's really,
we have,
I bet Captain Judy knows.
Judy knows where it is.
We know where it is, and we know it's leaking. And that's why your oysters are so big.
Don't say that.
We aren't glowing yet, though, fortunately.
No,
so, okay.
But we have caught some really strange fish.
Three-eyed.
Captain Judy, I wanted to talk about that. What I remember the first time going out with you, 2013, 2014, I remember you had this book and charts, and you know, a lot of people have their computers. You had the charts. What have you learned with those charts? Do you know every single bit of this ocean floor out there?
Well,
it seems you do.
I kind of think I do, but, you know, since I started before they even had Loran, you know, we would throw a buoy out as soon as we got where we were going, and we hoped we could find it after we drifted off of it. But, the fishing was different then. You could just throw your line anywhere and catch fish 50 miles offshore. But we went from Loran, which was a radio signal, to GPS, and then they had WASP where they might give you 300 feet. You know, and then they cut that off, and now we have 4 or 5 feet, and we can really find bottom now and go back to it before we had to look for it. But I've learned a lot about navigation, a bunch about watching the waves and the sky and birds and bait and everything. I think I might be able to find my way back if I didn't have all that, though.
Brian, I know the fish, the creatures, the birds that are in this part of the country have changed in recent years. What are you seeing that's new to the Georgia coast? I know I'm springing this one on you, but I've heard flamingos have started making their way
down
up
little
here.
Things like that.
What's happening?
We have certainly seen warming trends, and especially the past several winters, you know, have been warming. But like this past year, having some of the first documented natural expansion of mangroves coming up in Georgia, and this is something we typically think of our coastal wetlands. You know, we're a marsh dominated state. We certainly see up through the Atlantic seaboard fish population shifting northward. So, I mean, for things like sea bass, that maybe traditionally was more of a mid-Atlantic, we're seeing, you know, creeping further and further into the New England area, things with blue crabs moving. So we certainly are seeing shifts with species. There's also, you know, and this is where I love blending what the research piece and then the observations, because I might get out once or twice a month on the water. You're out literally probably 6 times a day. And I mean, that there's just very valuable information from our fishing industry of what they observe in these changes, because you're usually the first ones. Now, you know, they might have disagreement on what's causing some of these changes, but the fact that, hey, we used to never see white pelicans throughout the whole year, and all of a sudden now it's like it's not uncommon to see that, or even some of the fish species. We've always had, you know, we're in the northern range for like mangrove snapper or gray snapper, but just it's been interesting to hear, you know, more and more reports of the size increases, and not just the ones offshore, but things like, you know, snook even. Again, we're in the northern range, but more and more reports of some pretty hefty sized snook, which is generally considered a warm water species, and all of a sudden it's creeping into areas. And it's not like we're Minnesota here by any means, but traditionally a lot colder than what you'd see. So we are certainly seeing shifts in general, and whether those are always going to be negative things, maybe not. Even shrimp, in the past several years, Virginia has started a commercial shrimp fishery. Maryland has an experimental one going on here. Does that mean Georgia shrimp's going to leave? No, but the fact that we are seeing these northern shifts is something. The researchers at Gray's Reef, you know, you're seeing a lot more tropical species. You know, we've got one of the largest currents in the entire world off our coast here. And so that's a lot of movement coming from these tropical environments. What impacts, and it's not just the large species, but what impacts maybe from a microbiology aspect of what parasites would, you know, might potentially. And again, it might not always be a bad thing. It's just a lot of unknowns. So there's always that adaptability factor that managers, researchers, anglers, you know, captains are always going to have to deal with. I always remember etch and sketch. You know, we draw a picture of something and then it shakes and goes away. This is something we're in a very, you know, our dynamic environment here and along our coast.
Chef Dave, I know that a fork in the road, we feature a lot of chefs, we feature a lot of cooking, we talk to the farmers, we bring stuff back, someone at home, and I know every fish is different. let's say someone gets a sea bass on Captain Judy's boat.
All right.
Bring it home. How do you cook that thing?
Hopefully, Judy, you guys have taken the guts out of the inside.
Yes.
Taking the gills out, maybe.
I have cooked the fish with the guts in, but that was a mistake.
Yeah, don't do that again. For me, cooking whole fish, for me, is the best. I think the most popular whole fish might be a whole flounder that people love to score and fry. But, in fact, I think we did it on a show together.
Yeah, we did.
But you stuff the inside cavity of a sea bass, you've taken out the gills and the guts, you've taken off the scales, and just put it on a super hot grill. And then maybe finish roasting in the oven. For me, the bone helps protect the meat, helps keep it from drying out. Certainly, if you keep it in too long, it'll dry out regardless. But the flavor of cooking on the bone and getting that char of a grill, to me, is the best.
I love that. I shouldn't have asked that because I'm incredibly hungry right now. But that was a really bad. But we've been watching that video of the flounder up there as we prepared for this.
A toxic fire, a plume of smoke, and a community demanding answers. In Conyers, Georgia, the biolab disaster left residents searching for truth and accountability. This season, GPB uncovers system failures, hears from whistleblowers, and follows neighbors still fighting to be heard. I'm Pamela Kirkland. Join me for season 2 of Manufacturing Danger, the Biolab Story. Listen now at gpb.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Laura, explain hyper-regional and what it means to the oysters that you grow.
So especially right now where we are hand-delivering the oysters to restaurants, you know, part of our value proposition is that it was in the water 24 hours before it was served at the restaurant. That means that the brine that's in it is really fresh from the ocean, and it's a taste that's really from right around where you're dining. It's the same concept as wine. You know, a lot of times you'll hear sommeliers talk about the terroir. You know, in the ocean world, we call that a miroir. It's the taste of the brine and everything that goes into that. Here you see the, you know, local Spartina. It's got a grassy note. Obviously the salt, we have really high salinity. You can see the ocean from our lease, but it's a very unique flavor.
Captain Judy, how many times have you had to explain to people, you start going out in the boat, and they're like, this water's dirty, it's muddy, it doesn't look like Miami.
It's delicious.
Yeah, what's wrong with the water? Let's tell the truth about our water.
And why don't we stop hearing fish instead of ride and ride and ride, yeah.
Let's talk about the water and what that murkiness is.
And if you've been fishing in Florida, you know you can see the bottom. Well, you definitely can't see the bottom here. We have a mud bottom. The water goes in and out and brings all the mud, causes on low tide, you know, going to high, it just causes a dirty, muddy bottom. And sometimes you can see a tide line where the tide comes together and you got mud on one side and clear on another. But the further you get offshore, the nicer the water gets, but you still can't see the bottom. So,
but a lot of that is, as Laura will say, the nutrients.
And
Brian.
A lot of nutrients, yes.
Yeah, and that's what brings that terroir or miroir?
Miroir.
Miroir. To the oyster, to the fish. It's right. What they're eating. That is, it's murky, but it's healthy water. It's healthy water. Brian, we have special barrier islands, and they've been protected. What do those barrier islands mean to this entire coast, from Savannah down to St. Mary's?
Sure, so you think about, we have, 14 barrier islands. How many can we drive to by car? So I guess, four technically? That's one of the things I love when we talk about our coast, the history here. I mean, most of our, you know, this was a playground for a lot of wealthy Northerners, you know, historically. And a lot of that history has influenced now why we do have National Seashore. We have state parks. We have, you know, these wildlife refuges on our coast. So many of these barrier islands are only accessible by boat. You mentioned about birds, but if you think about the migratory flyways for a lot of our shore birds, these barrier islands are absolutely critical wildlife habitat. Things like our horseshoe crabs that depend on them, our sea turtles, you know, and that is something, again, over the past several decades, and Ms. Judy was talking about this, just the cycles that we see, all of our wildlife, and that's something, too, that maintaining that integrity of our coast absolutely supports these wildlife populations. And that goes back, again, to the tourism on here. I take for granted that I can see a dolphin almost every day, and it's just like people pay thousands of dollars to come see that. We are very fortunate, and it doesn't mean that we don't have some issues on the coast, but that is something that when people come here, realizing how special this place is because of that wildlife. And, you know, going back to what I said earlier, there's a lot of different organizations, different groups trying to make sure that we maintain that, so that, you know, that we want the tourism, you know, but we have to do that with responsible, you know, management. And that's the other thing too, is just, you know, when we look at our storms, how do we recover from that to make, you know, Mother Nature is going to do what Mother Nature does, but as we continue to, you know, live on these, we have to adapt to that. So we talk a lot more about resiliency now, and how, you know, is it going to be done in an equitable way, making sure all communities have that, the resources they need to get back and get back to working or have access to the resources. And so these are all things that are kind of intertwined with one another when we start talking about these, the barrier islands that protect us from these storms. Again, so there are playgrounds, but they're also our first line of defense. There are, you know, our wildlife areas. So there's so many different aspects about that that most people never get a chance to see. So I think that's a lot of thing. When people come here, they want those authentic experiences, whether it's going out. I can only imagine the stories your clients get to hear from you while they're reeling in fish. So that alone's worth the money. But then going to that restaurant, getting those oysters, it's part of a whole food system, I think. And your show is like that. I mean, I think it's not just the people that harvest it, but the entire, the rest of the tentacles that touch that and how that influences, whether it's someone who lives here or someone who's coming from Chattanooga, Atlanta, or further away.
That is something I've loved about the show. I've loved connecting chefs to the farmers. I've loved seeing the relationship between Charlie Phillips and his snapper, his clams, with Chef Dave. Chef Dave, I got to connect you with American Wagyu beef up there. You know, it's the connections that you all have made with people you've met. I think they are incredibly special. I want to lead to one other thing. I want another story. I want another story from Captain Judy. I'm feeling it. There was a certain 80s movie called St. Elmo's Fire.
Oh,
you experienced something.
Yes. Well, first I got to lay it out for you so you understand how bad it was. So I'm offshore again with a Loran, which is no way to know exactly where you are.
Loran is short for Long Range Navigation. It is a navigation system developed during World War II.
So when I rode 1 hour and 45 minutes, I throw the buoy out because I know, according to my father, 1 hour and 45 minutes at 90 degrees will take you to the snapper bank. So you throw the buoy out, right? So, and then you go to the buoy, you have them fit, you know, you let everybody drop, and then you drift away from the buoy. And then when you finish, you don't want to get too far from the buoy because you can't find it. So you go back to the buoy. Well, on my way back to the buoy, I couldn't find the buoy. And then I looked behind me, and I could see in my wake that I was just going in circles, kind of. I knew the buoy was 270 degrees from where I was drifting, but every time I tried to get to 270 degrees, the compass was just, I was following it and it was spinning. So I went, oh. And you couldn't really tell where the ocean stopped and the sky began. So you really just looked like one big mirror and no sun, but it was still daylight. And then so I decided to stop the boat because, boy, I was really trying to figure out. And I told the guys, I said, y'all going and fishing. Let me just think about this for a minute. So they're fishing, and every time they go to set the hook, it pops. It's like they pull it up, it pops. And I looked at the metal. All the metal on the boat had turned blue, and it looked like it was smoking, and looked like it was hot, but it wasn't. And then I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I don't know where the buoy is. Now my compass, I knew it was just spinning. I watched it spin around and around, and they were just setting the rod and it was popping. And then I looked back and everybody's hair was standing up on their heads.
Straight up.
And that's when I said, guys, can y'all just reel in your lines and sit for a few minutes because I'm not sure what we have.
And does that mean lightning's like about to strike you?
Or no, well, actually it has something to, I can't really explain it because I know I'll mess it up. But it's when the barometric pressure and all this gets the same, it creates this force field and it jumps on whatever's there. And it happened to be me, and I was the only one out there, of course. And so, you know, So my boat, I would have loved to see what it looked like from above. I mean, you know, it was blue. The metal was just, it was like this color, but it was metal.
Yeah.
You know, silver, and Lord have mercy. I was just so glad that the sun finally came out a little bit from behind the cloud and it went away.
If anybody wants to ever go to Captain Judy, just sign up for her emails, because she has these stories, and I'll read them. The last 10 years, I'll just start reading these stories. I'm like, how does she have more stories? I love it. And they're all good.
My daddy left me a lot to write about. Then I experienced some stuff, and I wrote about that.
Yeah. There's a lot going on here at the Georgia Coast.
I need to really write a lot more, because every day I remember something different.
You said Santa almost fired. I was thinking you're going to tell me she was like the, you know, standing with Rob Lowe or something during the movie. So
I took him fishing.
You went a completely different direction. Okay,
she took him fishing. I bet she did. You know, I learned something new every day from Captain Judy, it seems. But when it comes to the next generation learning, Laura, you're an educator. How important is it to you to teach these kids what you know, what Brian knows out there? You know, how important is it for this next generation to understand the coast and learn from us the struggles y'all have had?
I mean, I think the best thing any of us can be is curious and focused on solving problems. But you see that in young kids readily. You know, they haven't lost it yet. They're enthusiastic about things. So I really see oysters as really a hook. So it gives an anchor to have a young kid get excited about something and then be able to bring it full circle around sustainability and how they can truly have an impact at any age. So whether it's just learning and being able to talk about it, you know, you're at a friend's house and they're throwing stuff away, you know, maybe they understand the full circle implications of that. Or, you know, the opportunity to get them to come out and see the coast, especially for kids who don't get to see the pristine nature of it, and then also maybe see some trash. So they can compare and contrast and really have a powerful story to tell. And with the oysters, you know, we're looking at different ways of engaging them, whether it's from watching them grow and using it to tie into math curriculum, talking about the history of it here, talking about the science behind it, how they're filter feeders and what they do, and really just giving them a hook to find something that they can latch onto and take them into the future. You know, there's a story there about careers. Maybe they want to be an environmentalist or a biologist or an oyster farmer, you know, showing them there's options and different pathways for them to pursue, and also with a good intent of sustainability.
And go ahead, Brian. Add to that too. And whether they ended up being a biologist or a fisherman or whatever, even if they don't do any of those things, you know, maybe they're a county commissioner, maybe they're a mayor, maybe, you know, understanding the value that plays in our economy and our environment. I don't care if someone's on the left, on the right, blue, right, that's still part of our community. Yeah. So that is huge. So it doesn't always have to just be, and yes, I'm a science geek, but we don't just need scientists. We need people who live here who understand the value of that business or charter or a chef. So I think that what they're doing is amazing. And even from a community perspective now, I think for the people that are doing the oyster aquaculture, there's new initiatives. We recycle Shell. And again, a partnership, Shell to Shore, which is a nonprofit, DNR, Marine Extension Sea Grant. I know a lot of you guys are involved too. But we eat oysters. I mean, we eat lots of oysters, even if it's not from Georgia. Those shells can become habitat. And so there's initiatives now, especially in Metro Atlanta, we're talking tons of shell. Well, instead of that entering landfills, how can that make it back to the coast so they can do habitat restoration? So now when you take a charter group out and fish for trout or something else, you know, or Dave, so that full cycle. And so that's what's pretty cool about education. It's not just the food, but I mean, that shell from the minute you eat it to the minute we put it back in the water has value back on our coast.
We actually, right here on Tybee, some students at Tybee Island Maritime Academy petitioned city council as a result of one of our initiatives. You know, Tybee Oyster came and spoke in the classroom, and their problem was about sustainable solutions, using nature-based sustainable solutions. Yeah. So they pitched to city council to bring shell recycling back to Tybee, and it actually was passed. And that was in partnership with Shell to Shore. Yeah.
I mean, if we can get the kids just interested, whatever position they might hold, if they love it, they're going to want to do something to help it. Yep. And so, you know, for me, it's through fishing. If I can get a kid to love fishing, whether it's fly fishing, conventional, get them on the water, even if they're from Chattanooga or Macon or something, they're still going to want to help protect it. And with the teachers doing that especially, that's what's going to take, is that next generation caring enough about it to help it.
Yeah, absolutely. As a chef and as a captain, Dave, what do you think people need to know about the Georgia coast? I know it's a broad question, but what's the most important thing that people need to understand about this Georgia coast? And we could even go down the line on this one.
Good question.
Wow. It's strong and fragile at the same time, but really bad answer. Sorry. It's resilient. It's been around forever. It's proud. The people are proud. The communities are strong. We love it. We're always going to do whatever we can to keep it going. It's fragile. It's one storm away. It's one algae bloom away. It's one chemical accident away from not being what we want it to be. It just needs our attention. Sometimes it just needs to be loved, but sometimes it needs a big hug.
Yeah. Laura?
It's pristine. It's a great playground, but it's also something to protect. You know, there's that balance of enjoying it, respecting it, and just, you know, preserving it.
Absolutely. And Brian, this is something you've researched, so you could write a book right now.
Oh, my head's spinning because I was like, man, different. On a very basic level, don't take for granted what we have. I mean, look at other coastal states. And again, do we have our issues here? Of course. Do we have impaired sites in certain communities? Absolutely. Does everyone have equal access to some of our resources? Not all the time. But largely, we do have a relatively pristine coast. And just, I would kind of add the conservation aspect, using wise use. You know, we are... That's something that we should be proud of, that we have this history of harvesting the shrimp, crabs, oysters. Going back to your previous question about the next generation, making sure we keep doing that. But, you know, I think what we've heard so far, yeah, let's not take for granted, because when it, you know, it's a lot easier to, you know, look at other examples around the U.S. when we've had major incidents, or when things have gotten so developed to the point where you can't recognize it. We still have a wonderful thing on this coast, and I think, you know, let's not take it for granted.
Yes. Well,
Captain Judy.
I think the coast is wonderful. Our coast is untouched. It's not overpopulated. And it's our way to get to the ocean. So we really mm-hmm. have to take care of it if we want to go to the ocean. And people nowadays, you don't see people throwing trash over as much as you used to. People pick their trash up. You don't see people, you know, throwing oil cans in the water. And a long time ago, you did see that. People used to throw their trash every night into the creek, and you don't see that anymore. People now have their trash picked up, but before it wasn't that way. So I think you have a lot more people taking care of the coast than you think. And you know, like they That's go to the point. Barrier Islands and they pick trash up. Mm-hmm. Because people go to the Barrier Islands. I couldn't imagine the Barrier Islands not exist. Tybee is not big enough to hold all the people. There's 200 boats sometime at Wausau when I come in the afternoons. Mm. And then Beach Hammock, there's at least 100 boats there. So can you imagine if they had to all go to Tybee to go to a beach? Yeah. So people, I think people are starting to get it.
And know? That's what I love. This is called Hope on the Water. And part of what I wanted to, you know, there are some downsides. We did point those out, but what I love just going through here, every single one of you talked about the hope. Like, yeah, you know what? If we do this right, things can be okay. What do we still need to do?
Just keep the momentum going. There are always going to be new ideas. There are going to be new problems. We need more solutions. But you, to Brian's point, don't take it for granted. Just keep the momentum going, because it's not going to stop. And it's some of the panels that we've sit on that, you know, I was on a panel for 9 years. Judy's going back on to one. It's always participating and keeping it going.
And anytime I like guest lecture, I'll tell sustainability is not an endpoint. It's like, okay, we're sustainable now. For today, maybe. But then, I mean, again, I go back to the fisheries management. What might be not overfished today, it could be a human-caused issue. It could be a natural thing. So I think that's something we're always going to have to deal with. That, great, we've done a living shoreline, but in 5 years it might be gone, and we might have to come up with the next solution. So I think that's always where that innovation, the ideas are going to continue flowing. And we're always going to have new people coming to the coast. As an educator, the worst thing we can do is assume, oh, well, everybody knows that. No, they don't. And so I think even though sometimes we might feel like a broken record, but that's kind of where it does take all hands to help with that. So just keep in mind that as much as we're making forward progress, don't take that for granted that it's just going to be an endpoint. There's always going to be something else coming down that, you know, and it might be a financial issue, might be an environmental issue, cultural issue. If it was that simple, we would have already solved all these things, but there's always going to be more complex issues that it's going to involve more people getting involved.
I think we should just pass it down the line, you know, pay it forward. Tell everybody, you don't really have to tell everybody, but show everybody that we need to take care of our resource. And I know we don't like regulations. I hate them worse than ever, but especially about Red Snapper. I'm not going to talk about Red Snapper. I talk about it too much. So
that's all right.
So, you know, we just got to take care of our resource.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get a little lighter here because we're getting towards the end of this. But I warned y'all of this question. Not warned, but told you about it. Man, I don't know where to start.
I didn't get any memos.
Okay. Then we'll let you go second.
Don't put me.
Laura, you pull some crazy oysters out of the water, I'm sure. What is the craziest thing you've seen in your time on the water? Whether it's in the water, whether it's floating.
I mean, the coolest thing I've seen recently, we had a turtle, not sure what variety it was, but it was literally we were working the equipment. So we use a system called Flip Farm where you hook up to the equipment with something on the side of your boat, and the baskets kind of come up at like a ramp and then tump open. And we're just running down the line at a pretty slow pace, doing some maintenance on baskets and checking in them. And I saw a turtle that was just sitting in one spot, letting the baskets come past it and just eating off of it. Very efficient.
Buffet.
I have hit the jackpot. It's like the revolving sushi restaurant and pooler, but we had it on our farm. Yeah.
But maybe he or she was cleaning the basket for you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was okay. Very symbiotic. It was fun to watch. I have to admit, I got really distracted and probably stopped working for a while, but yeah.
And did you name this turtle?
I didn't, no.
Okay, next time. Start showing up. You got to name the turtle.
I know. Yeah.
All right, Brian. Craziest thing that you've been in the mud. I've seen your Facebook pictures of crazy little things I've never seen before in your hand. Yeah. Why do you touch it? Do you know what it is?
First off, the mud, man. If anyone's never taken the Pluff Mud Plunge, that's another thing.
Explain that real quick.
So if you've never gone in our marsh, which I advise everyone in this room should, you know, we have very extensive marsh systems. It is not uncommon. You get into the Pluff Mud that really kind of looks like sheeny. You go like kind of that sheen on the top. I mean, I've been up to my chest or deeper. And I was telling David earlier, we've had researchers that like will come out with us and they're wearing waders and we like take them off. Mm-hmm. And they don't understand that because they can go into these areas. And I mean, it actually does become a hazard. And one of my colleagues, Lisa, has had to pull someone who just, no, I can handle it. And next thing you know, it was like cementing someone in there. So
quicksand.
Coastal quicksand.
Yeah.
Coastal quicksand.
But fish thing, okay, so crazy work-wise, we were working with South Carolina Department of Natural Resources on some sea turtle work off Jekyll. And we caught a sawfish, which this was close to 15 foot. Pre-pandemic. It was fascinating. You know, it was one of those things, just the fish geek in me was just like, and then of course it's like, oh, we need to get it out. So the biologists were taken out of the net. Come to find out, they had a receiver on there. This was in July. Come to find out, Florida State University had tagged that fish in April in Key West, down in Key West. It had pinged off St. Augustine, I think by like late May, June, and we caught it off July. So and if you've ever seen a sawfish, just very kind of like a shark and a saw combined, just beautiful, beautiful animal. So to get to see that. So that was the work fish. And then the personal story, we were fishing for grouper. My line broke off. Okay, well, we did okay. And we had our dive gear. So we decided let's go diving. Come to find out, I'm coming across and I see this red grouper and it's not moving. I thought that was weird. And when I got closer, I noticed it had a hook in its mouth and line and a sinker. And I was like, God, that looks just like my rig. I got to catch my own fish because it had snuck in the, it was undersized. So I couldn't keep it regardless, but I at least got the circle hook out of its mouth.
You saved it.
So I saved my own fish that broke off earlier.
That counts as a catch.
It does.
Hey, listen.
You
could count it.
Yeah. All right. Chef Captain Dave, gave you a little bit of time here.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Yes, absolutely.
It's hard to narrow it down. I mean, so many beautiful things. The sun rising, you know, with the Spanish moss and the fog over the water I'm partial to tarpon, watching tarpon jump, seeing sturgeon free jump out of the water has been amazing.
How big do those get?
What, 100 pounds?
Sturgeon?
Yeah.
More than that? Yeah.
Prehistoric. Yeah, and they look like dinosaurs coming out with a pink belly and these triangles are just really, really cool. I've seen an eagle come down and grab lunch out of the water and grab a fish. Awesome. Pretty neat. Mm-hmm. The coolest thing maybe, and it's a little violent, is watching a gator eat a pig on the side of the marsh off by Little St. Simon's.
Okay, I was going to ask where.
It's really violent, but you're not going to see that sitting at home.
You're not.
Kids, you see it every day on the Georgia coast.
That to me was probably the weirdest thing, and that's Mother Nature at her finest.
Yeah, you can't cry. It's kind of a sad scene, I guess, but it's Mother Nature.
It's Mother Nature.
There you go. Yeah.
Jeez, it was.
You like that one. Now, Captain Judy, I was with you one day, and we heard a whale. I didn't get to see it. I'm sure you've seen your share of right whales, but cool. Tell me what you've seen out
there.
Well,
the right whale is really very nice and beautiful and large. And before they restricted us from getting close, I used to provide Gray's Reef with all the video.
Now, when she says Gray's Reef, she is talking about Gray's Reef National Marine Sanctuary. This sanctuary provides year-round opportunities for sport fishing, recreational diving, and boating. And the research area within the sanctuary hosts one of the only designated no-take zones in the region, which makes Gray's Reef a catalyst for scientific research, studying water quality, ocean noise, hurricane prediction, and climate change.
Because we figured out that there'd be whales trails. When there was a whale on the bottom, their tail brings up like a, what do they call those? Well, anyway, I forgot. But so the whale's tail brings up the bottom, and it comes up, and you can follow it because the birds follow the whales, you know, the stuff from the bottom, the sediment that comes up.
The whale trail.
We also figured out that when a whale gets tired or he wants to look around, in 30 foot of water, he just puts his tail down and sticks his head out. I got pictures of their heads sticking out the water, and I swear I think they're looking around because... I got close enough to take a picture, like, from here to there.
Wow,
we were allowed, awesome. You know, there wasn't really any rules back then. And it's called an upwelling, you know, how the water goes over a ledge and it boils down on the bottom and brings all the sediment up. Well, that's what a whale's tail does. So we could find them, you know.
Wow.
We found some of them that weighed 80, they were like 80 foot long. Babies, mothers, you know, it was really cool. So the other thing is, we caught this fish one time, and I've been fishing a long time, as you know. I did not know what it was, and I'm like, oh my God. My daddy always told me, don't touch anything if it's pretty, and don't touch any pretty fish, because they're bound to bite you or they're poisonous. So here it comes, and the sky it's about this long, and it's got these blue spots on it. And I'm like, oh my, it's a pattern. Oh my God, I'm trying to figure out how I'm gonna do this. I don't wanna kill it and I don't wanna touch it. It's got a bill like a duck. Its eyes are sitting on top of its bill. It's got little teeth, but not bad. I finally got the hook out, but I took a bunch of great pictures.
We got one up there.
Oh, there it is.
It is.
That's a blue spotted cornet. Now, I've never seen one. Divers have seen them, but they're blue spotted cornet. It's a weird, look at his eyes.
How long is that? Yeah. How long is that fish?
He's this long.
This long. For our audio audience, it is the biggest fish tail you've ever seen.
I have to say 4 foot plus.
4 foot plus. That is an awesome
fish. Did the audio audience also get the small teeth reference?
She's making motions with her hands.
We did get the hook out, and he did swim off. So everybody was, but the guy was so funny. He says, what is it? And I said, I don't know. And he says, well, if you don't know, who does? I said, I'll call somebody when I get home, you know. And I did. But I've never, you know, everything's coming from the south up. So, you know, all kind of different fish are moving in our area.
But that makes me feel better, like when someone like Judy doesn't know. Oh, yeah, and that's,
I mean,
that does
know.
Show. Like, I mean, even when you think, okay, I have a pretty good grasp on it, and then you see something.
That's pretty cool, though. You know?
Yeah.
It makes you realize how all those pirate tales came to be, all the serpents, all the fantasy, what
yeah,
is under there?
They
we
were
just
drinking.
Know a fraction.
They, you know, water was, they mixed rum with water. They were drunk all the time.
But we got the proof. We got the proof up there. You all, I want to thank you so much for being a part of this podcast. You all are friends. I've gotten to know all of you on camera, off camera. Being up here today, hearing the stories. Y'all, thank you so much for being here today. This has been a great event. I hope our audience here has gotten a lot out of it. For more stories like this one, you can watch A Fork in the Road on GPB TV or anytime on the GPB.org website. That's where you'll also be able to listen to and subscribe to this podcast or download it on your favorite podcast platform.
Oh, and my phone number's 912. Best Student Charter's 912-897-4921. Call me.
There you go. I'm David Zelsky. Thanks for listening to A Fork in the Road.